Welcome to iDeveloper Live, episode 12. It's great to see you all out there in the chat room being so helpful already before we've even really got going. I've been too loud, I've been too quiet, I've not been heard at all. Probably the last one was preferred by all. But that again might be the case as well for Mr. John Fox, if he is still here.
I'm still here, and who wouldn't want to hear from me?
John, we haven't got that long. It's only a 45-minute show. And so it's great to have you on again, John. And Mr. Danny Gregg, are you with us?
I am indeed, Scotty. How are you?
I am really well, thank you. And all the better for speaking to you. And in fact, we have discovered that we must be Siamese twins separated at birth because we have identical voice patterns because I thought you were my echo.
Well, what can I say? When you're as talented as us, you've got such smooth, silky voices, so it's easy to be mistaken.
Yeah, well, let's not really go there, shall we? Right, okay, and we see we've got loads of the normal suspects in the chat room, so we can expect the normal low quality from them as well. So the show is going off at the normal level. This is great. This is great. So let's start with a little bit of news. Danny, just before we came on air, you were talking about some more App Store rejections. Now, we haven't really necessarily followed these up. We may be totally inaccurate, but this is where we're going to rely on the chat room to sort us out a little bit. But you were talking about some people got rejected for having something to do with Dropbox in their application.
No, I think I was actually misinterpreting something that Justin tweeted. Looking at this, it was readability was who I was thinking of. They just got rejected, and it was because of using a payment system other than the in-app purchasing, which for me is far less controversial than I was hoping for. But I'm frantically reading the blog post now, and it seems to just because they have their own subscription system. Chat room, if you want to help me out, that would be great.
So they have their own subscription system, but they're not. But they don't offer subscriptions in their app. That's why they got rejected, or did they also offer it in their app?
My frantic reading of this now seems to be the fact that they don't do Apple's approved subscription method, and yet they still have their own subscription method. Seems to be the reason they got rejected, which is pretty much straightforward in the guidelines if you ask me, but there we go.
Well, there we are. So that was really uncontroversial. So there we are. We've really started very well. Although I have to say, all this subscription stuff is just, every time Apple do something, it stirs it all up. I don't know if you read a blog post, a Tumblr post from Isaiah, or is it Carew? That's his name.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
He said Apple's three laws for developers is what he put out in this Tumblr post. Law number one, a developer may not injure Apple or through inaction allow Apple to come to harm. Law number two, a developer must obey any orders given to it by Apple, except where such orders would conflict with law number one. Law number three, a developer must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with law number one or law number two. So basically, that just about sums up what a lot of people are feeling at the moment. And yet, you know, apps keep getting put in the App Store, and it's, are Apple going to be able to just keep doing whatever they like, or is there going to come a point where people are just going to say, you know, that's enough?
Well, as long as people keep buying iPads and iPhones, then Apple are going to keep doing whatever the hell they want, if you ask me. Pretty simple, really. If people keep buying it, seems to be what people want. Obviously, if your average Joe goes and buys an iPhone, they're not really thinking about, however much Google like to say it, they're not really thinking about, oh, developers are restricted in this system, maybe I won't buy this phone. So as long as Apple keep making record-breaking sales, I don't think they'll see the need for their developer policies to change.
Could you simulate the voices that somebody's mom has in her head when she's at the store trying to figure out whether to buy an Apple phone or an Android-powered phone?
No, that's really stretching my acting abilities a little bit too far, if I'm honest. I just can't get my head around wanting to buy Android, which is, you know, that's the biggest acting challenge.
Oh.
I would try, John, but I only do amateur dramatics, and this is a professional show, so the two would not mix. There we are, moving on. I think with the start that we've had, we need to get onto something that we know is going to be really, really good. So I think we better set off with a bit of Cocoa Fusion. Mr. Danny Gregg of No Thirst Software is here to do Cocoa Fusion. What are we talking about today, Danny?
We're going to talk a bit about core data migration, following on nicely from Kevin's chat last week.
So basically, you're a really synchronized company and you all worked this out together and this has been in the planning for weeks, yeah?
It just happens to be that we're working on some of this stuff at the moment, and when we all panic because we haven't done a segment, this is our go-to topic.
Right, okay, fire away.
Basically, we're just going to cover the simple fact that if you want to develop an application with core data, at some point you're going to want to obviously change the model, almost inevitably, unless you make 1.0 and then get really fed up and don't ever develop on it again. But luckily, since, I don't know about when, I think it's sort of since Leopard, there's been an inbuilt migration system in core data itself. To first understand it, the best way to start is to look at how core data actually versions, stores, and their models. And the way it does this is with a set of hashes for each entity in your model. So every model you create has these version hashes, and every store which is produced from one of these models has these set of hashes in its metadata. So every time, for example, you change an attribute on an entity, that will of course change its hash, its version hash, because the entity itself has changed. So it's a really simple way for core data to look at a store coming from disk and say, well, this was clearly made with this set of entities, and then compare to the model that you're trying to load it into and say, and these are the entities that we're trying to load into, and see if there's any compatibility issues there. Now, it does that automatically, but it also exposes some APIs if you want to dig into it, which is entity version hashes by name on NS managed object model. That will just give you straight back the version hashes for those entities. And then also you can get them from the metadata of a persistent store. If anyone's not familiar, every persistent store written out from core data has a sort of a metadata section in it, which you can get by calling metadata for persistent store. In that metadata, there is a key, NS store model version hashes key, and that will give you back the version hashes in the same format as the ones you got by calling entity version hashes by name on NS managed object model. Now, most of the time, all you're going to want to do is do a simple compatibility check on your store, on your model. And luckily, there's actually a way that core data does that built in, as opposed to going through the hashes itself. And that is on NS managed object model, you can call is configuration compatible with store metadata. And that will just give you back a simple yes or no as to whether this store is compatible with the model. So what that gives us is a really handy way to actually trigger off a migration process. So if you get your store from disk and you've got your model initialized, call is configuration compatible with store metadata. If you get a no, kick off a migration. Now, as for the migration itself, there's two options for you. And which option is your best fit is entirely dependent on the scope of the migration itself, the amount of changes and how complex they are. For simple migrations, now we're talking, when I say simple, I mean, for example, just adding an attribute to an existing entity. For example, making something which is optional, not optional, or if it was optional, making it not optional, but then also supplying a default value. So then obviously core data, it's quite obvious the path that it should take migrating those particular changes. So if you've got something simple like that, you can use what is called in core data terms, lightweight migration. And for anything more complex, or if you want more control over it, anything like that, through you use sort of proper migration. There's no name for the actual method. I don't know. I call it proper.
So that's a Danny Gregg invention, proper migration. So if you're not
migration,
if you're not doing it the Danny Gregg way, it's not proper. So basically, the reality probably is, and other for the most simplest of stores and the simplest of changes, lightweight migration might get you through, but really you want to be looking at proper migration.
Yes, absolutely. If you want my opinion, I would never put anything in a shipping product without with lightweight migration, because I don't like the lack of control Because if you're obviously going through the full complete process, you can put various checks in at different places, so you don't ever screw up the document, or at least you know what happened as it was going through and errored. But where lightweight migration is handy is if, for example, you're going through beta testing and you just missed one attribute, you know, and you really can't be bothered to write a whole mapping model and everything. Obviously, we'll come to that. Just enabling lightweight migration for that release to get everyone up to speed is, you know, much simpler than going through the whole motions just for a beta release. So that's when I would use it.
Okay, so all right. So we'll accept for now that a lot of the time we're not going to be using this. So let's go for the full Monty. Let's dig straight in at the the whole big thing. Let's forget all this easy sort of it can do it for you stuff. Let's go for the real man's way of doing it.
I think that's the best way. Especially as lightweight migration is kind of modeled on this anyway, so it'll give you an understanding of the process. So the first thing you want to do when you're dealing with migration is you need to keep hold of your old data model documents. That's the first thing, because Core Data is going to use them to understand how your data coming from legacy stores should be modeled. So if you get rid of them, it's not going to have any clue. So you'll be in serious trouble. So make sure you hold on to those old data model documents. The second thing you need to do is start creating mapping models. And this is where the fun starts. If you have, for example, we have our source store and our target store, source model, target model. What you want to do to create a mapping model is go through the new file kind of workflow in Xcode, just like you're adding a class. But you go to new file, and then what you want to do is select the mapping model template. Now, that is, I think, in Xcode 3 in the other group, and in Xcode 4, the core data group. I may be wrong. I'm kind of putting them off the top of my head. But they're somewhere. Choose mapping model. Then in the next step, it will ask you to set the source and destination models. Now that's obviously quite simple. It's the source that you're migrating from and the model you're migrating from and migrating to, respectively. So once you select them, it will create this mapping model for you, which is kind of, you know, your basic... a basic mapping. It will look for any consistencies in the two models, you know, where entities are named the same and they've got similar key or the same named keys. It will just put the mapping straight across.
So if you've only sort of added a few a few fields or maybe another entity to your store model, then, you know, this thing is going to suss out 95%, 99% of the mapping for you, because it's actually just mapping straight old to new. Nothing's changed, and then only leaves you to sort out the new stuff. So for smallest changes, if you're not renaming anything as such, but maybe adding or taking away, this tends to get it mostly right?
Absolutely. It's usually pretty much spot on. Obviously, anything like you rename, it will completely slip up because it has no idea what you've renamed it to. But if the names are similar, it will map them straight across, and you'll probably find yourself just needing to do a quick once-over to make sure everything's correct, and that's good to go. However, obviously, quite a lot of the time, you're going to have a few more complex migrations. Renaming is one that comes up often. That's my phone. obviously, when you rename, you break that association with Core Data. It can't spot that it's the same key. So what you can do is there's a whole UI for creating and working with mapping models. Obviously, that's quite hard to describe over a podcast, but it's fairly self-explanatory. But you get there's the ability to set source keys, and if their relationships change the mapping that's generating the new relationship, it should be fairly simple to work out. But that's pretty much it. If you're doing a rename, you just have to go through to find the new key and just say the source value, put that key path in, the old key path in there, and that should work out just fine. Playing around with the mapping model editor and looking at blog posts with screenshots is the easiest way to get familiar. It's quite simple. It's just quite hard to describe over a podcast because obviously it's not source code. The other thing you can do with mappings is, of course, if they're even more complex, it's not just mapping a straight value for value, is you can drop down into Objective-C. this is for basically anything more complex than that, because we're obviously all Objective-C programmers. We're much more comfortable in that. And when we're in here, we've got the whole power of Cocoa or whole power of Core Data. And what we do here is we subclass something called NS Entity Migration Policy, which I recommend everyone open up the header right now so you can see, follow along through. But the class has two methods of real interest, and that's create destination instances for source instance, entity mapping manager error, and create relationships for destination instance, entity mapping manager error. There are other kind of entry and exit points and cleanup points as well in that class, but those are the two main methods. Now, whenever you're writing your migration, your custom mapping in here, you've got access to two contexts. One context, which is set up with the old model, and one which is set up with the new model. And you can access through them through the NS Migration Manager, which is passed into both of those methods I described. So basically, you now have the ultimate flexibility. You have two contexts, your source and your target context. And so you can query the source context as much as you like to create any new NS managed objects. And all you have to do is create them in the new context and they will be there. There are a couple, once the migration is completed, that is. There are a couple of gotchas. The first one is the entity migration is a two-step process. First, all managed objects in the entity are migrated. Then the relationships are wired together. So those methods I described aren't called one after the other for the same instance. That won't happen. You'll find that it creates all the destination instances for the entity. Then it will go through and wire up the relationships. Because obviously what it's doing in between time is it's migrating the objects on the other entities in your model. So when it comes to wiring up the relationships, you have all the migrated objects. So then all you have to do is map them together. The other is once you've migrated, say you create a managed object in your migration into your target context, you need to tell the mapping manager that what that object represents in terms of an old object, so it knows when it comes to wire up the relationships what it should wire everything to. And you do this by calling associate source instance with destination instance for entity mapping. Excuse me. And that therefore tells the manager this is what this used to be, therefore anything else which has references to this old object, use this new one instead. That makes sense?
Makes sense to me.
Good.
Sorry, I mean, were you expecting a little bit more interest than that? You were doing such a good job that it just didn't seem to make sense to you. Why disturb you? People complained before that we were not giving enough tech and getting distracted by other things, and I wasn't trying to distract you, and so there we are. But next time you ask me a question, I will come back with a better response for you, Danny.
That's all right. It's only because I find, obviously, just reading off method names and class names, I get lost in my own notes, which I did about 3 times there. So so I can understand if it gets hard to follow.
Don't think you're the only one getting lost.
Well, I have a question. Maybe I should hold off until later, or should I ask it now? It has to
I was just about to dive into lightweight migration.
Okay, go ahead.
So if it's to do with complex migration, ask it now.
Well, so the question comes having to do with primary keys. Now, I have to admit, I don't use Core Data. My experience was EOF, and I've been using Datacrux, so all my migrations, all the stuff I do by hand. I already wrote all this code for doing it. But is there a way in Core Data to be able to use a UUID as a primary key, which in my mind would make migration a little bit easier when you're having to do this two-step process to convert all the destinations and then wire up the relationships? Or is that much of an issue?
No, not really. I mean, this is where all the database people shoot me. But Core Data is not a database and doesn't really have the same concept of primary keys. So when it comes to migration, for example, in those custom policies, it will just say, well, here's where all your old stuff is. Where do you want it? In the new model. So in terms of setting UUIDs as a primary key, it's not really an issue. Because, well, basically, NS managed objects have one because they have their managed object ID. So Core Data can keep track of it during its lifetime anyway, which I would assume would solve any issues you would have. So I'd imagine that's how it gets around it. But so we can go on to lightweight migration, which is, you know, as I was saying, the cop-out migration if you've got not much of a change. And basically, the process and the back end is identical. But the whole goal of lightweight migration is for Core Data to synthesize the mapping model by looking between differences between the source store and the target model. And therefore, that will drastically reduce the amount of work you actually need to do to basically nothing. If you've got no mapping model to create, no custom policies, because it's figuring everything out for you, which is why you understand it can only possibly work for very simple changes. So to get that, all you have to do is set a couple of options when you're adding the store to your coordinator, and that you need to set NS migrate persistent stores automatically option, quite a mouthful, and NS infer mapping model automatically option to yes. That's it. Obviously, those are all documented. If you Google lightweight migration Core Data, it will all come up. But literally, all you're doing is telling the persistent store coordinator that, hey, make sure you infer any models automatically if you can't find anything. And it will give that a crack. And it will obviously happily fail if it's too complex for it.
So you're expecting us to say something again now, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I've kind of come to the end.
I mean, this stuff is you know, a big improvement on where we used to be. I mean, you know, the whole big issue with Core Data used to be, how do I get from one version of my app to the next in taking it through? So even though that may sound like it's a whole bunch of hassle, what you've just described, actually it's pretty powerful and actually makes the job, let's say, it's pretty labor intensive sometimes, but actually it does do the job, doesn't it?
I mean, some of the things I've done with this migration system, you can pretty much do anything. For example, one time we had a library bundle in Little Snapper, which was just a whole bunch of flat, it was one flat database file and then a whole bunch of images. And we changed it so every single snap or image became a bundle in itself with a whole bunch of information in it. And I did the whole thing through the Core Data migration process. So creating things on disk, moving them around, because you've got access to all of Coco. If you create custom entity migrations, you can do pretty much anything you like. And when you said that, that's labor intensive, yes. But then for simple stuff, just generating a mapping model, like you were saying, if it's just a couple of changes, it will probably be 95% done for you. So most of the time, the kind of work is very much relevant. The amount of what you need to put in is very much related to what you actually need to do, which is, you know, just what we want.
When you're testing these things, do you ever kind of simulate desperate failure? Do you ever kind of try and interrupt the migration in midstream to make sure that, you know, everything goes back to its prior state, or is that kind of handled for you?
Oh, no. I completely try to screw with it. But if I'm honest, what I do is I have my own migration set up where I just tell it, because I've just realized I didn't actually put this in here, but you can actually trigger a migration by saying, you know, manage object context, migrate this for me. And so what I tend to do is, that might not be on the manage object context, I can't remember. But what I tend to do is I take a store, and I say, okay, migrate this. But what I'll do is I'll copy it first temporarily. So it's in a, you know, it's in a temporary place. So the actual store that we're migrating is not the original. So if something catastrophic does go wrong, you know, we just nothing has happened as far as the app's concerned, because it'll just try and load up the old store.
And is that something that you do as a matter of course with only when you're doing testing? I didn't follow.
Sorry, yeah, that's what I do as a matter of course.
Okay,
just to make sure that there's no anything that could screw up your data. In my opinion, should happen in something new or away from the original source. So you've always got the original source to go back to, to roll back to.
And Kevin wants to know, well, Danny, doesn't Core Data do migration to a temp source anyway?
Man, this is the thing. I don't think it does. I need to actually look at some of my code.
Well, Kevin, Danny's tried to tell you that he doesn't know.
I can't remember, but I think I tell it to go into a temporary source. Obviously, my look of being the expert has drastically failed around me now, but I don't think it does.
Well, there we are. We'll leave you to look that up, Danny. But thanks for that. I think that's a subject that everyone using Core Data needs to get into and understand. So that's been pretty useful. So let's have a big virtual out there on the internet round of applause for Mr. Danny Gregg.
I'll take a virtual applause.
Yeah, that was just overwhelming. Thank you, John. talking of keeping things temporary and always be able to go back, what source control management system do you use, John?
I use GitHub. Git
through GitHub, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah,
the best thing about Git is GitHub.
Yeah, no, we at NoThirst Software use and approve Git and GitHub. Git and GitHub, there's just nothing like it.
I'm a Git and GitHub reader. Now, I'm just thinking, a couple of years ago, GitX was about the only GUI if you wanted to use something visual for working with Git. That sums that up. Just over the last 12 months, there have been so many sort of new Git interfaces coming out. And I was just reading a review, a side-by-side review of some of them today. And I was just wondering if you had any experience of any of them, or do you stick with the command line? Do you feel that Git is really just supposed to be about command line, or do you use any of the visual tools? Same question in the chat room. Anyone out there using any visual tools with Git?
Oh man, this Kevin and Mike are gonna love me being on for this, because I know they very much agree with me when I say I don't like any single Git GUI out there. I don't think anything comes close to what Git can do on the command line or does it justice. I've tried lots of them, but I really don't think it comes close to the flexibility or power you get on the command line. Most of them, because Git does several things, there's sort of several ways to do different things. Quite a lot of the time, one or two of the GUIs will do something wrong, in my opinion, and there's no way to change that. And that will frustrate me no end. So I've never fallen in love with any of the Git GUIs.
Okay, John, what about you? Do you use anything visual, or are you a purely command line man?
I use the command line. I have to admit that I don't. My uses of it are probably simple enough that I don't know. I've been using the same kind of simple set of commands since CVS, and it just every time I move when I move from CVS to Subversion and then to Git, it's kind of I just don't look down and try to remember a couple of simple commands.
Really, really pushing the source control system to the limit, John.
Absolutely. Well, but the reality is, I don't have that complex of needs for it. So,
well, out in the chat room, Gitbox is getting a little bit of love. Tower is getting lots of love. That's from Simon Wolf and Kevin loves Tower. He's the boss. You should be looking to him, Danny, for inspiration.
I
example.
Did them a massive.
I thought
injustice.
Love Tower was the name of your new band.
Oh my God, that was.
We're moving on quickly.
Wow.
So maybe we need to get Widget Press and Simon on at some point to do the Gitbox versus Tower Smackdown.
But they're just wrong.
Danny, we've asked you now. We've asked you now. You've had your opinion. Shut up. Mr. Legg is talking about a product that we cannot mention without risk of being taken off the air by those that are
who's we may be harming in step three.
Oh, actually, that's a good point. I use that redacted product has a very nice way to quickly look back, and also to be fair, diff tools as well. I use Kaleidoscope as a diffing tool.
Okay, that's another good one. What diff tools people out there are you using? I use Kaleidoscope. I love Kaleidoscope. I think Kaleidoscope is brilliant. John, what do you use, a diff tool, or do you just print it out on paper and use a highlighter?
No, I use Kaleidoscope, and before that, just file merge. So,
I actually use both. I have Kaleidoscope set up as a diff tool because Kaleidoscope with Git is just incredible. It has this whole dedicated system for Git diffs, which is awesome. And also I use file merge for my merge tool, because Kaleidoscope doesn't do actual merging. And file merge is still the only one I've found with a common ancestor, which merge tool fully supports. So I just do git merge tool, and then completely build out my merge in file merge, save it, git figures everything out and says, cool, that was fine, which I just love. I just love the way everything works together like that.
So how often do you find yourself with nasty merge problems? Like, because, you know, part of the reason why I don't have complex needs is because I'm virtually the sole programmer of Memory Miner. And when other people have been working on it, they've been working on separate parts of it, you know, on plugins or kind of black box portions of it. Do you find yourself with merge problems regularly because you're always tromping all over each other's work? Is it a huge issue?
Actually, no. Git usually does a pretty damn good job of merging anything we've come across. The one spanner in the works, or rather two spanners in the works, are zibs and project files. Although I've occasionally have Git successfully merge a project file if usually if both of us have, you know, added files being the normal one, that will usually screw things up. But other than that, they're usually quite a simple merge to do, relatively speaking. So that's never really a problem. And we do something called Git flow. So we're merging and branching constantly throughout the day. So in terms of relative speaking, compared to the number of merging collisions I had versus merges in Subversion, it's next to nothing.
Yeah, I just realized, having pictures of you, I'm supposed to have the right one on the screen, and you've just looked just like John for the whole of that conversation there, Danny. But never mind, never mind. There we are. I mean, my main problem with the moment, I haven't looked at Gitbox yet, so maybe I'm going to have to do that. My main problem with Tower at the moment is quite a few of the projects I'm working on use submodules, and I don't think the support is really is there for submodules in Tower yet. But there we are. That's a whole new world, the world of submodules. It's in there. So I think out there in the chat room, would that be an interesting sort of SmackDown discussion to have with people who think that a tool bash out, find someone from a lover of each tool and do some stuff? If you think that's a good idea, drop me an email, put something in the chat room. A tool bash out. Yes, very good, Danny. Thank you very much.
I didn't want to say that online.
There we are. You are. It doesn't matter, because you know it's going to get read out. Right, okay. Let's swiftly moving on. Do you know what? I need to make sure the camera actually points at something that's actually worth looking at next time. I know me, I am worth looking at, but it's just mainly looking in my ear at the moment. Okay, so I just want to close down today. We're coming up to our 45 minutes by talking about Developers Against Poverty. Firstly, I want to say a big thank you to the developer community that have contributed so far, because in 20 days we hit our $50,000 target. I think that deserves a big woo 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 woo. we need to find some round of applause effects somewhere in Logic, because that just wasn't impressive. That is absolutely fantastic, but the thing is, just 90 donations. I know there was one huge whacking great donation in there of $35,000, but 90 donations now, every week, sort of somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 people listen to this podcast. I know you can't believe that so many people are that desperate for listening to,
for entertainment.
Listening to this claptrap, but there we are. And so only 90 people of that fourth. Now I know everybody else is preparing, to do a day, or to do some sort of scheme, or just to put something in at the end, or so, lots of people are taking a percentage of the sales over a certain month. So I know there's a lot more people waiting out there. So I've upped the target to 75,000. I wondered about 100, but I thought, no, let's do 75,000. And so I'm just encouraging everyone out there, because that will be 3,750 people we'll get clean water for 20 years if we hit that target. So developersagainstpoverty.org. Go give your cash on iDeveloper TV. iDeveloper TV this Friday. What's the date this Friday? Someone tell me the date this Friday. Any idea, anybody?
I don't know how to use a calendar.
No, I'm just
this Friday is the 25th of February.
The 25th. Friday the 25th of February is Developers Against Poverty Day. 100% of all sales on this Friday, iDeveloper TV will go to Developers Against Poverty. So if you've been thinking about buying a course from there, then you know, I don't mind if you wait till Friday to buy it, and it all goes to Developers Against Poverty because it's a good cause, even if I say so myself. Right, do we have anything out there that we have to talk about today? Is there anything out there that we would just be considered completely unprofessional if we didn't cover before before we signed off for this show?
I think in general the most professional thing we can do at such junctures is to is to not say anything, or at least for me.
You've been
It's too late. I just did.
Yeah. There we are. There we are. Okay. Well, this has been a slightly shorter show, but we're back. Actually, we're back to the 45 minutes, which is what I wanted to aim for. Mainly taken up by Danny Gregg with an excellent Coco Fusion segment. Danny, tell us where you're from. Everybody should know now. All your fan base are in the chat room. They're all whooping and a hollering for you. Even your boss is there saying, "I love my boy. I love my boy."
And tell us when the next concert date for Love Tower is.
Oh my god.
Just this is not just going away.
I'm just the whipping boy, aren't I? I don't like this. I am from Scotty, before John cuts in with another disgusting joke. I am Danny Gregg from No Thirst Software. We make financial products for Mac, iPhone, and soon to be iPad. You can find us at nothirst.com.
Soon to be iPad.
Yeah. Maybe I should say not so soon, just to make sure no one gets too keen about that.
And John, everyone knows who you are, but tell us again anyway.
You can find me on memoryminer.com for my product, and I blog about it at memoryminer.com/blog. And on Twitter, you can find me as Djembe, D-J-E-M-B-E, like the West African drum.
Now, I'm Scotty. You can follow me at MacDevNet, iDeveloper.tv to go and buy loads of stuff. Don't forget Developers Against Poverty, developersagainstpoverty.org to go and do good in this world. Now, next week, we're going to be doing more Coco Fusion. No idea what the subject is going to be because I don't find out till about 10 minutes before the show, because why would anyone want to tell me? So that's it. But John, we have a special guest on in the business section next week. Do you want to just give us a bit of a preview?
No. Yes, I will. No, we're going to be. I'm actually looking forward to next week. We're going to be talking with a fellow named Brendan Clavin, who has a localization as a service offering now, which I'm incredibly happy to be helping to act as a guinea pig, because this is we'll learn about it next week. How about that?
Yeah, so we're looking at localization and service and all that sort of stuff. So tune in. It's 10 a.m. Pacific time. That's 1800 or 6 p.m. GMT. And you can work it out in between and beyond, because you are developers and you can do math. The amount of people who miss this show because they can't work out time zones. Oh, my word. What sort of software are you writing? Anyway, until next time. I do apologize. You all take care. Oh,